content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Ebony Magazine, January 2019 edition. On the cover of this edition is Michelle Obama, and we will go over her story on this last week of January. But first thing first, let's get started with another article coming from our cultural section on our radar. Black men in white coats. HBCU alums Hope memoir and tour will redefine the image of African-American male doctors and encourage a new generation to pursue medicine. As struggling pre-med students at Xavier University in New Orleans in 1998, Pierre Johnson and Maxim Matter expected to spend long hours in the campus library. They never imagined that while there, they would befriend a classmate and form bonds that would reshape the course of their lives. Their fateful connection unfolded one day during a marathon study session at the public student hub at the historically black university known for helping produce top-notch black doctors. The new study partners struck up a conversation with Joseph Seaman, a New Orleans native. During that conversation, they learned that they all experienced similar challenges growing up as young African American men. Seaman had sold drugs in the streets of New Orleans. Madier had faced gun violence as a teen in Washington, D.C., and Johnson endured the instability of being exposed to drug-addictive relatives in Chicago. They also learned that as former star students, they were all struggling academically for the first time in their lives and grappling with self-doubt and depression as a result. We were all struggling with self-confidence, recalls Madier, age 37. We were from three different walks of life, but we quickly saw that we had all a lot of similarities as black males coming up in the crack era. It was divine intervention that we met. Instead of succumbing to bravado and choosing to view each other as adversaries in the highly competitive environment, they opted to become allies. Eventually, they would make a promise, a pact, actually, to hold each other accountable personally and academically, and to work tirelessly to help each other succeed. We started having a discussion about the struggles we were having and how we were trying to fight it out on our own, recalls Johnson, age 38. As the conversation went on, we began to see the drive in each other. Then we realized that we needed each other to help navigate the tough times that we were going through. Instantly, we started meeting in the library and began to push each other. Then something special happened, says Seaman. We formed a brotherhood that became a family. It would be a long, twisting, and tumultuous road, but each man stayed the course and made it to medical school. Now they share the honor and privilege of having MD behind their names, and 20 years later, their friendship remains intact. Seaman is an OBGYN at Lake Charles Memorial Hospital in Louisiana. Madier is a cardiologist, anesthesiologist, and partner at Anesthesiology Group Associates in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Johnson works as an OBGYN for Chicago Metro OBGYN in Harvey, Illinois. The trio chronicled their struggles navigating the travails of college, medical school, and beyond in a memoir, Pulse of Perseverance, Three Black Doctors on Their Journey to Success. Since the book's release in early 2018, the men have crisscrossed the country to speak at schools, churches, and civic and medical groups, detailing how they leaned on each other to become the seemingly unsurmountable odds they say many black youth face today. We're about challenging and ultimately changing the narrative about black men that is projected in the media, that we're only good at sports and entertainment, Madier, says Madier. The problem is that the value of education often gets diminished in that image. We want to tap that underdeveloped talent and potential in our black youth. Along with highlighting their personal journeys, the doctors say they're also using the book and speaking tour to raise awareness about the need for more people of African descent in medicine, especially African American men. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, only about 4% of U.S. doctors are black, and black males represent about 2% of medical school graduates. One startling AAMC report also found that in 2014, fewer black men were enrolled in medical school than when the number mushroomed in 1978. The statistics are especially concerning because studies find that black patients, especially men, tend to receive higher quality, life-saving care from doctors of the same race. Seaman, age 40, says there's also a critical need for more clinicians of color, physicians who conduct medical research that aids in the development of treatment and pharmaceutical drugs, particularly for conditions that disproportionately affect black people. The bottom line is that nobody can take care of blacks like we as black physicians can. We understand the culture and can take a more holistic approach to meet their needs, he says. That's why we need more people who look like us into medicine. The doctors have visited such cities as Atlanta and Chicago in recent months to spread this message. At one of several speaking engagements in the Atlanta area last summer, they spoke with the Wired Youth Ministry at Berean Christian Church. James Fisher, a high school senior who heard the doctor speak in Atlanta, says, "They said things like anything is possible and anyone can be us. I've heard these things before, but they personally moved me when they shared struggles." In people's success stories, they usually have no struggles that they like to share. The doctors opened up about them and ended up telling us how to overcome them. A lot of people forget their roots. For these men, it is the total opposite. Philip Nash, pastor of pastoral care at Berean, was also energized. "It was refreshing to hear those from the black community come in and basically pull a Marcus Garvey, each one reach one kind of thing," he says. It encouraged him to keep achieving and get back to finishing his own graduate studies in pastoral counseling and leadership, he says. Though informal in their strategy, the doctors turned authors' diversity efforts as are similar to other initiatives that have emerged in recent years, such as White Coats for Black Lives and the social media campaign hashtag Black Men in Medicine. The AAMC's reports also inspired Dale Okududu to launch his Black Men in White Coats campaign in 2013. While he was a resident at Duke University Medical School, his initiative includes a mentorship program for pre-med students and video profiles of young black doctors that are posted on medical school websites and social media. Akadudu, now a Dallas-based pulmonary and critical care physician, says he applauds the Pulse authors for projecting a positive image of black men. "All we hear about is black males playing sports or being entertainers, and that is such a small number of people. Why aren't they showing the 90% of us out there just being dads, taking care of our families, and doing the many exceptional things that we do every day?" asked Okududu, a father of three children who also wrote the parent guide, How to Raise a Doctor, Wisdom from Parents Who Did It. Although drawing attention to the dearth of doctor diversity is a centerpiece of their message, the three insist that their formula for success can be applied to any profession. "Our overall mission was not just to talk about the medical field, but our goal is to inspire and empower young black children and provide a blueprint for success," Madir said, explains. with their own money and what they earn from speaking engagements, they're funding a mentorship program and a monthly scholarship award to help medical school students. They hope to expand their message to new platforms such as a TV show. We now understand that all of the obstacles and struggles that we overcame were placed in our lives for a higher purpose, says Johnson. We believe God placed us in this position to show others what to do and how to do it. So on to our cover story on Becoming Michelle. The road of self-discovery has led Michelle Obama from the tough Chicago streets to the storied halls of Princeton and on to the White House, where she emerged as one of the most elegant and accomplished first ladies ever. In her new memoir, she explains why she won't run for president, but will stay committed to public service, her family, and luckily for us, being a role model we can bank on. Sunbeams streamed warmly through the elegant glass-ceiling courtyard at the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. in February, or rather last February, illuminating the thousands who gathered for the return of Michelle and Barack Obama to the public stage. Artists Amy Sherald and Kehinde Wiley unveiled their portraits of the former FLOTUS and POTUS, the ceremony feeling far more like an easygoing homecoming than a stodgy museum reveal. Standing tall alongside this canvas of her grayscale portrait, flashing her wide smile and wearing a long sleeve floral navy gown, Michelle LaVon Robinson Obama commanded as much love and attention as she ever did in her 8 years in the White House, all held in the forever mom in chief as she beamed. The sold out superstar sized stadiums of a 10 city tour for her new memoir proves that sunlight winter day was the barest of warm-ups. Becoming by Michelle Obama, published by Crown Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, traces her journeys from the south side of Chicago to her Harvard law-educated tenure at Sidley, Austin to America's most beloved first lady, and all points in between. Her White House vegetable garden and battle against childhood obesity, her Reach Higher and Let Girls Learn education initiatives, her style iconic to of Vogue covers, her relaxed appearances on Ellen and Carpool Karaoke, rapping breezily with Missy Elliott, Michelle Obama's dignity and polish have been sorely missed since the Obama's exit from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, hence the Beyoncé-sized audiences for her book tour. So in this particular article, Ebony's asking her a series of questions, and then she's also responding. So the first question that Ebony asked her was, what have you found most liberating about your post-White House life? You know, it might be the amount of time I'm able to spend in jeans or workout pants. In the prologue of the book, I share an antidote from the early months after we left the White House. It was just me and our two dogs sitting outside doing nothing. I've had more time to do that, to just exit in the world, to just be. I realize now that I may not have fully understood everything I was carrying around with me for a decade or so, all the duties and expectations, both for myself and from others, that surrounded me every single day. Writing the book gave me a chance to process all of that. Barack's had a chance to decompress as well. He doesn't have to carry the weight of world around him anymore. No one's following him around with the nuclear codes. Don't get me wrong, we were incredibly blessed to have lived in the White House and served the American people. And we were given opportunities to do good that we never would have thought possible for ourselves. But I think 8 years is about as long as somebody should live inside that bubble. Especially somebody with a young family, it's healthy for our lives to swing back together or towards something a little closer to normal. I've been able to go out to dinner in public, more often. I've gone for long hikes in the mountains. I've still got a Secret Service detail with me all the time, but I'm able to move and live with more freedom, more lightness, and I'm not going to lie, I'm enjoying it. The world at large has tried its best to accept that you won't run for office, but how seriously did you consider running for a political office at all, and what made you decide against it? To be completely honest, I've never considered running for office, seriously or otherwise. Really, for me, deciding to run for office would be like deciding to live on the moon. Politics is just not the place for me. I'm not cut out to make a life there. It's too chaotic, too messy, and the tribalism and nastiness aren't something I want to experience day to day. I'm someone who prefers order and calm, and politics doesn't offer that. That said, I still care deeply about the future of the country, and after watching Barack serve for 8 years, I believe more strongly than ever that we need good people leading us in elected office at every level. People not just with the necessary skills and intellect, but with the character and compassion to stand up for folks who don't have a voice. As I see it, though there are a lot of other ways to contribute in our country, speaking out for people and causes that can make or can use a boost, making sure everyone feels like they have a say in this democracy, advocating for young people. Those are some of the areas where I've devoted myself since I left the White House, and I'll continue to do so in the years ahead, because as I've always said, it's not enough just to climb up the ladder and make a life for yourself. You got to reach back and help others along the way. Black women are often conditioned to uplift and adopt a save the world mentality, and the world often turns to black women for rescue. Can you speak to where this item or this stems from and why this black woman as savior superhero idea is unfair? First of all, I don't think people should be turning to any one individual to save them from some outside force, unless the individual is themselves. If we're frustrated about something, whether that's in politics or in our communities or in our jobs, we need a lot more people to look at themselves for an answer before throwing all their hopes into someone else to save the day. We saw some of that while Barack was president. It's a nice daydream to think that one person can do it all, but in the end, it's just that, a dream. It's the hope that we can have everything we want without doing anything we don't want to do. Unfortunately, the world doesn't work that way. As for why the world sometimes looks to black women, and I have to say that I wish the world turned to black women more often than it does, I think it's because we got a perspective often that it I think it's because we got a perspective in all our own. If you're growing up black and female, you can't help but learn what's really going on down on the ground. You're going to see a lot of bottoms of people's shoes coming down on you, so you learn to be nimble and resourceful. You learn to be grateful for wherever or whatever you have. You learn to find the good in things. From our vantage point as black women, we spend a lot of time looking upward. All of that hardened practically, that loving optimism filters into our voices as we grow older and more confident in ourselves. We become people who aren't willing to sit idle by it. Something's going wrong at home or work. The trick is just that we need more people who are willing to listen to black women, especially young black women, to lift up our voices rather than shutting us down. As you describe in Becoming, a high school counselor once said you weren't Princeton material. What can be done to bolster the self-confidence of young black America to push against those who want them to think small? This is a good example of what I'm talking about. When I was a teenager, a high school counselor of mine took one look at me and decided I wouldn't be able to cut into the Ivy League. It's one of those moments that I realize now could have broken me. I walked away from that meeting with a bruised ego. I wasn't sure what to think about myself. My own brother had gotten into Princeton just 2 years earlier, but I now was being told by someone whose job it was to support kids in this process, no less that I wasn't good enough. What I did was channel that hurt into a singular focus on getting into Princeton and proving that counselor wrong. I studied hard and asked for help when I needed it. I put a lot of work into my college essays and I shared my whole story. What it was like growing up with a dad who had multiple cirrhosis, the fact that my parents did not have much money and hadn't graduated from college. I didn't shy away from any of it. And a few months later, I got in. Now I was lucky. I had a mom and a dad who gave me the skills to channel my frustration into something productive. They instilled in me a sense of my own worth, the belief that my goals are achievable, and most important, they taught me to focus on controlling the things I could control and not worry about the things I couldn't. I think that I couldn't control what the counselor said to me any more than I could control if a mall cop hovered over my friends and me as we shopped in a department store. But I could control how I responded to that stuff. It's pretty wise advice. As I've grown older, I've seen a lot more wisdom in my parents' ways than I did as a teenager. And I think it probably would serve us all as we think about the things our kids are up against. Because we can't control other people's expectations, some folks are going to see a black boy with a hoodie and think he's a thug. Some folks are going to see a black girl speaking up in class and think she's too loud or too bossy. A lot of times, folks aren't going to see those kids at all. We've come a long way since I was a kid, but all of that is still a cold truth in 2018. The good news is that none of this is insurmountable. We've got to help our kids believe in their own stories, every part of their stories, the ups and downs. We've got to show them that their strength is found in what's so often perceived by society as a weakness. Their skin is too dark. Their family doesn't make enough money. They live in a tough neighborhood. All of that is what makes them who they are. And it's what can help them overcome the slights when they come. That doesn't mean they're going to be free from pain and hurt. But if we can help them see the beauty in their stories, if we can keep these aspirations sky high, and if we can do it day after day and year after year, I think we'll get them a boost that can help them brush all anybody who doubts them. What made you decide not to bicker at Princeton like your college friend, Suzanne Allel? I think I should first help our readers understand what it means to bicker. Because I certainly didn't know when I arrived at Princeton as a kid from the south side of Chicago. There was a whole new vocabulary for me to learn on campus, an entire language of privilege I hadn't been exposed to. For instance, a lot of students came to campus already knowing the meaning of a term like precept. But when I first heard it, I mostly just smiled and nodded, just like I did when someone told me about their experience playing squash or lacrosse. The same goes for bickering. For all intents and purposes, I learned soon enough bickering is an eating club, was like rushing in a sorority or fraternity. At Princeton, they just called it something else. Now, my friend Suzanne was a bright light in my life, someone whose smile and energy was infectious. She was messy, and I was clean. She was a free spirit, and I was always worried about my to-do list. Similarly, she clicked with all sorts of different people, and that meant she was more comfortable exploring the bickering process, which meant branching outside of her social circle, mostly African-American students. Meanwhile, I was content with the friends that I had. I knew they had my back, and I knew I needed that kind of comfort and security to get through school. Suzanne was different from me, and that's what made us friends. So I sometimes wish I ventured outside of my comfort zone. Sure, a little, but the truth is I was happy with my scene. Besides, we quickly realized that the few friends of ours who bickered, including soon enough Suzanne, didn't end up spending much time at their eating clubs anyway. They ended up eating with us. I guess we all gravitate toward those who make us feel like we belong, the people who make us feel like we're home. You wrote that as First Lady, you wanted to honor the legacies of Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, Rosa Parks, and Coretta Scott King. Can you expand on that responsibility? I tried to never let myself forget that I was blessed to live a life that those women never could have imagined. And that includes my life before I was First Lady. I was a lawyer making a salary that would have made their heads spin. I led a nonprofit, rubbed elbows with the mayor and local philanthropists. I managed a department at a hospital and rallied a community for change. Whatever the slights and challenges I experienced along the way, I was walking in a path that was far smoother than anything that women who came before me experienced. Because of their dignity and perseverance, I was able to take advantage of the incredible opportunities. The motto from your speech at the 2006 Democratic Convention, "When they go low, we go high," became your most inspirational phrase. Is there another message you wish had become as universally praised and quoted? As I mentioned, I try not to worry about things that I can't control and trying to figure out whether or not to line or phrase is going to catch on is a great way to write a terrible speech. I thought that part of my responsibility as First Lady was to exhibit a level of composure and integrity and set a good example for the country, especially for kids. I knew that kids were watching everything I did, and they're not shy about asking questions. What's that word mean? Why are they acting like that? Can I do that? I hope that we could be an ally to every parent in this country, even if some of those parents didn't agree with politics. Barack and I tried to be our best selves. We tried to stay optimistic, as hard as it was sometimes, because in the end, I think that's the kind of country we all want to be a part of. One where we try to see the best in each other rather than automatically assuming the worst. And it looks like that we have actually run out of time today for today's episode of Ebony Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Nicole Hunter, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our website. After the broadcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.